It's a Woman Crush Wednesday. Join Professor Buzzkill as he crushes on women from history who deserve more fame and glory.
Okay, Buzzkillers, it's a Woman Crush Wednesday here at the Buzzkill Institute. And of course, like always, we bring you the best historians to talk about important people from the past who deserve more fame and glory. And fortunately with us over the internet is Sharon Spaulding, a historian from the Northeast in New England, who's here to talk about someone who really, really needs a lot more attention. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy your podcast, and love the opportunity to speak about this particular person.
Well, let's tell the Buzzkillers who this particular person is.
Mary Ware Dennett.
Mary Ware Dennett, okay.
Yep.
When was she born?
Mary Ware Dennett was born in 1872 outside of Boston, and she died in 1947 outside of New York City.
And what was her sort of early life like? As everyone will learn in a few minutes, she becomes extremely important later on. But how does her background sort of set her up for her work?
Well, so let me just start by saying something about her background, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because most people, really out beyond academic circles, most people have never heard her name. And yet last year, Time Magazine included her among a list of the 9 most important women in American history.
Wow.
And I'm on a mission to make sure that everybody does know her name. She was remarkable because she touched so many different arenas. And she worked as an artist. She was a leader in the suffrage movement. She was a leader in the reproductive rights, sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also a champion for freedom of speech and First Amendment rights.
Okay. Well, like I said, she's one of these many people who is one of the reasons we have these Woman Crush Wednesdays. They need more attention.
Yeah. Well, her background, to answer your question about her early life, her first interest really from the age of 6 was to be an artist.
Uh-huh.
And I have letters of hers when she was 6 years old lamenting the fact that they don't teach drawing in school, because more than anything, that's what she wants to do.
Uh-huh.
So her focus, you know, eventually she does become an artist. She attends the Boston Museum School and graduates from there with honors, goes on to become a professor of art at Drexel in Philadelphia, and then has quite a successful career in the arts and crafts movement. She's a founder of the first Arts and Crafts Society in Boston, and opens the first artist cooperative in the United States.
That the arts and crafts movement is a very, very big thing at the time, right? And to be one of the first women involved in founding a cooperative is amazing. Was she born to a wealthy family or a well-off family that allowed her to do this, or did she have to struggle all on her way up?
So she was born to a very, I would say, not a wealthy family at all, a family that believed in hard work and they believed in the value of education. She came from a long line of New Englanders. Her father was a dealer in hides and furs, but he died as a young man and when she was just 10 years old. So from that point on, her mother really struggled and ended up really having to reinvent herself. She was a young widow. When he died, you know, he had debts. He didn't leave the family any money. And Mary and her 2 siblings and her mother ended up moving in with 2 aunts and an uncle. And those 2 aunts were early feminists. One of them was among the first women to graduate from MIT.
Oh, right. Oh.
The other went on to head the Massachusetts Woman Suffrage Association and also was a peace activist in the 20th century. So she was surrounded by a family that struggled financially, but they were remarkable because they cobbled their incomes together and ended up buying a brownstone in Boston that her mother ran as a boarding house. And, you know, even though they weren't wealthy, they were among, you know, they entertained a lot of Boston's intellectual elite at the time.
Right. Right. Okay.
But, so they were very progressive in many, many ways.
But things really seemed to accelerate or take on an intensification when then she marries and then has difficulties with childbirth, right?
Yes. So she, it's interesting because her, you know, stepping back a little bit, you know, to the time when she's in her teens, she is so committed to being an artist. She's, right. I have this journal of hers that she wrote when she was 15, and she talks about going to these slumber parties with her girlfriends. And the friends are talking about, you know, the kind of man they want to marry. Mm-hmm. And Mary is talking about how, well, the person that she'd like to marry, and she'll only marry if he supports her work as an artist. So she's already thinking in terms of, well, I only want a partner. You know, I want a true partner, or I don't want to get married.
Yeah, right.
And then in 1893, or perhaps earlier, she meets the man of her dreams, falls in love. He's an architect. You know, they share the same views on art and the value of art. They consider themselves to be a progressive and modern couple. So they do get married in 1900. They hang out a joint shingle. So they're working together. And then sadly, with her first delivery, she has a very difficult time in childbirth. Then she has a second delivery that almost kills her. And the baby dies just 3 weeks after, you know, after being born. And then her last delivery in 1905, the doctor says, really, that's it, no more, because you will die if you have another child.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the problem, the thing that people have to realize is that at that time, contraception was illegal.
Right, right.
The Comstock laws had been passed in 1873, and the Comstock laws was the name given to the country's obscenity laws. But they prohibited not only the sale of any kind of contraceptive devices, but any information. So it was illegal for doctors to discuss contraception with their patients. Parents could not talk to their children about how to prevent pregnancy. So for Mary, you know, being told that she can't have any more children, it means they can't have sex.
Right. Sure. Sure. So it's because as far as she knows, but if that's the sort of ethos at the time,
right,
it's not surprising that she has to follow it. But then her husband starts to, let's say, misbehave in terms of his marital vows. It's sort of a strange story. And that certainly, again, accelerates her desire to fight for women's rights.
It does. It does. So what happens is that because of the complications in childbirth, she has to leave, and she ends up going to New York for a surgery and for a long convalescence. And while she's gone, there is a project for a couple in Boston, a doctor and his wife, that she's not able to work on because she's physically not able. Her husband falls in love with the wife of this client, this Dr. Chase's wife, Margaret. And when Mary gets home, she realizes that, you know, he's really not in love with her anymore. And eventually what happens is that her husband and this other couple decide that they want to start a commune in New Hampshire. So this other couple has two children. Mary and her husband have two children. And the three of them decide, let's go to New Hampshire with the kids. We'll start a commune. And Mary says, no way, I'm not going to do that. I'm not sharing my husband. I'm not sharing my children. That really catapults her into the women's movement. She ends up at the time, you know, it's sad. It's a sad situation because she's still very much in love with him. And she keeps thinking he'll come to his senses eventually. So she doesn't file for divorce, but she does file for custody of her children. And she gets it, which is also unheard of in 1908.
Oh, that's sure. Yeah. Sure.
A remarkable thing to have accomplished. But at that point, too, he ends up sticking her with lots of debts. So she has to continue, you know, she has to go back to work to be able to support herself and her, you know, their two sons. She doesn't want to continue with the artwork because it's just too bound up in her relationship with him and work that they had done together. So she ends up joining the Massachusetts Woman Suffrage Association. which is now run by her, one of her two aunts that she had grown up with.
Oh, right.
Lucia.
Yeah, okay.
Lucia Ames Mead.
And this is 1908.
This is 1908. Right? Yep. This is 1908. Okay. So what happens, though, is that she finds that she's really good at organizing. And it gives her life a whole new purpose, a new focus. She starts crisscrossing the state and, you know, winning votes for suffrage, winning converts to the movement. And then in about 1910, the National Woman Suffrage Association in New York says, hey, we want you. You know, they've noticed.
Right.
And they recruit her to come to New York in 1910.
Well, I'm also looking at just a sort of a list of the organizations she joins and helps work with. She found something called the Twilight Sleep Association, which is about helping women be anesthetized during childbirth. She also joins the Women's Peace Party in 1914, the anti-war work. It's as if almost, oh, and here's another one, the American Union Against Militarism, which is very similar.
Yeah.
It's amazing that she has all this dynamism at a time when presumably her kids are still youngish and she's also having this big change in her personal life.
Well, she was, you know, the thing about Mary that is always remarkable to me is she was a believer, I think, first and foremost in equality. And when she talked about equality, she meant economic opportunity for everyone. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't just focused on one cause, but I think she was one of those, you know, kind of harking back another generation. She was one of those people who believed in the promises of the Declaration of Independence. And she really believed that, you know, that you could change the world, that you could leave the world a better place. And so the causes that she devotes herself to really fall out of that commitment and that ideal, that principle of making the world right and making it better for everyone.
Yes. And part of that then also, again, this activity is so vigorous between 1908 and 1914. She joins the birth control movement in 1914.
Well, she actually is a founder of the birth control movement.
I just want to
correct that because
Well, because it's important because people, they know Margaret Sanger, but they don't know anybody else.
That's correct. So she, in 1914, she meets Margaret Sanger and at a meeting of something called Heterodoxy, which is a whole nother subject, but it's like a secret sorority of women activists and artists from all walks of life in New York. So she meets Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger then, of course, flees the country because, you know, rather than face trial, she's been indicted. And in her absence, Mary Ware starts helping with the legal campaign for Margaret Sanger's husband, who has been entrapped by Anthony Comstock in handing over birth control literature. She ends up resigning from the Women's Suffrage Association and starts the first National Birth Control League in 1915, along with two other women. And then that continues as an organization until about 1918, when it dissolves and then becomes the Voluntary Parenthood Association.
Yes, but I noticed that in one of your articles that she not only founds these associations, she writes an extremely important pamphlet/book about birth control and about sex life, really. Which proves to be sort of controversial, but also really helps generate interest in birth control.
Yeah, it's called The Sex Side of Life, An Explanation for Young People. And she wrote that also in the summer of 1915.
Right.
So by this time, her oldest son is 15 years old, and she wants to teach him the facts of life. But she looks around and she can't find any material that she thinks is suitable for her son. She wants both of her kids to grow up knowing the facts rather than being, you know, learning myths or learning things on the street or associating sex with shame. And there happens to be a competition for a magazine about a sex, you know, a pamphlet for teenagers on basically what they called social hygiene, which really is sex education. So she enters the contest. She does not get the prize, but her pamphlet, her sons loved the pamphlet and they said, yep, mom, that is just the ticket. Thank you. So she starts circulating it among her friends who hand it off to their friends. And by 1918, it makes its way into the Medical Review of Reviews in New York. They publish it, but yeah. they give her the rights to future publication.
Oh, okay.
So that little book, you know, today, I mean, we would almost laugh because it's so straightforward, but she illustrated it with anatomically correct drawings. And there is nothing like this out there at the time.
Sure.
Nothing.
Sure.
So this little pamphlet eventually, by 1929, well, actually by 1925, there is a postal ban on this booklet because it's considered lewd, lascivious, and obscene
right.
under the Comstock laws. In 1929, she is indicted, arrested, tried, and convicted for having sent this publication through the mail. The ACLU rises to her defense, and there is evidence that she's a co-founder of the organization that eventually becomes the ACLU.
Oh, right.
She wins her case on appeal. And when she wins that case on appeal in 1930, it sets the legal precedent that enables publication of James Joyce's Ulysses, which had been banned in the United States, and also Marie Stopes's books, Married Love, and other publications that she had written.
But what's interesting about this part of the story to me is that she's published the pamphlet in 1915, right? She's not hiding it. It's not a secret thing,
right?
But is there a backlash later in 1928? There's a 10-year-ish gap. There's a backlash later that someone realizes, oh, wait a minute, now this is a violation of the Comstock law. So
yes,
let's nab her.
Yeah, no, it exactly. Seems to be... So what happens is that in 1918, she dissolves the National Birth Control League and starts a new organization in its place called the Voluntary Parenthood League.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of that is to lobby Congress to remove the words lewd, lascivious, and obscene from the Comstock laws in conjunction with birth control.
Okay.
So she starts lobbying. She spends a lot of time in Washington. She writes, you know, she drafts legislation and she, you know, the poor woman just works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nonstop to get this legislation voted on and to drum up enough support to pass it. What happens is in the process of all of this, she goes to the Postmaster General because she realizes that the Postmaster General could enact much of these changes just with the stroke of a pen. He then agrees to do it, but then resigns his position. So ultimately what happens is that it's a government sting operation in which she's entrapped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's payback for all of her years lobbying Congress and lobbying the post office to change the laws.
But she sticks with it and, you know, appeals the decision, as you say, ultimately is overturned in 1930. Is this the beginning of more acceptable, frank, no, I don't want to say open because that's probably too strong a word, birth control literature from then on? Or does it, in other words, does this start the ball rolling towards eventual sex education classes?
Well, it does. I think it does. Because again, when she writes this in 1915, there is nothing it on the market. Nothing. And then, you know, slowly, by the time she's indicted in 1929, public perception has changed. And colleges are now using her booklet.
Right.
Schools are using her booklet. Churches are using her booklet. Youth organizations. It's being sold around the world. So there, you know, at least from a societal standpoint, there's acceptance of this, you know, and a demand for more sex education materials. But sadly, today, there's still only 17 states in the U.S. that mandate that sex education materials be medically accurate.
That's so strange. That she would be turning in her grave over that, presumably.
Oh, she would. She would be horrified. She would be horrified that we're still debating all of these issues today.
Nearly 100 years later.
Yes, yes. And that access to birth control is under attack.
Yes,
I think
absolutely.
She would be, you know, she'd be leading the charge.
It does, it seems there's so many aspects. When you study these reformers in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the progressive era and things like that, you really sort of begin to be disheartened because so many things actually seem to be going backwards 100 years later.
Yes, I agree.
Well, what happens then to her after 1930? You say she lives till after the war, after World War II. Does she continue this in her final decade? Continue this sort of work?
You know, what happens, there's a couple of things. You know, she continues. She mails this booklet out to anybody who mails her a quarter.
Oh.
And in fact, her family, the descendants, continued to mail out The Sex Side of Life until about 1964. Requests still came in from all over the world.
Right.
And, you know, off it would be shipped to different, you know, people requesting it. So she continues that, but she also, you know, with the advent of World War I, she declared herself as a pacifist.
Right.
And you mentioned that briefly, but it was a very, very important part of her life, her peace activism and her work towards international peace. So in the 1930s, and I don't know the exact year, but she becomes a founder of what's called the World Federalist Association.
Right, right.
And she becomes the interim director of that, the first interim executive director. So she continues with both, but pretty much, you know, her life, I think, is really overshadowed by the Depression and then by the advent of World War II.
Yes.
At that time. She also, during that period, goes back to her artwork. And it's ironic, it's just kind of a footnote, but in 1925, she decides, okay, I'm done. Congress is not going to pass this legislation.
Right.
I'm going to go back to my artwork. So she does continue as an artist, but again, with the Depression, you know, commissions are far and few between.
Sure, sure. Well, then what happens to her after World War II?
At some point towards the end of the 1930s, very beginning of the 1940s, she moves in with one of her two sons.
Uh-huh.
And then she suffers a series of strokes.
All right.
So the last 2 years of her life, she lives in the equivalent of a nursing home.
Right.
And then dies from a stroke in 1947.
Now, it seems to me that one has to be an awfully, you know, serious student of the birth control movement and these other movements in order to have heard about her. One of the things I like so much about your work is one of the articles I was reading, you sort of took us on an archival journey about how you found a lot of these things. And one of the phrases that you or the reporter who was interviewing you used is, you know, don't go off and necessarily Marie Kondo your house, clean out everything you have, because you have to be careful. You might be throwing away someone's valuable historical life, the evidence of it. So how did you find this material and how did you then work through it?
Well, I married one of Mary Ware Dennett's great grandsons. So I married.
Oh, it's an inside job.
Yes,
then
it's okay. An inside job. I married into the family, and the family still has house in New Hampshire, where Mary Ware's husband, you know, started his commune.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the house, you know, ended up passing to their oldest son, Mary Ware's oldest son, so that when she died, all of her papers, most of her papers, ended up being carted up to the attic and, you know, basically kind of thrown into steamer trunks. So
yeah.
When I first started visiting that house, her son, her oldest son, was living in the house, and he was one of these delightful people. He had been a barnstormer in his early days. He played honky-tonk piano, and he'd sit around and he'd play this out-of-tune upright piano and then tell these stories about her and all the things that she had done. And, you know, I considered myself to be pretty knowledgeable, but I'd never heard of her. And I thought, yeah, he's just exaggerating a little bit. And then I started going up into the attic and opening up these trunks. And of course, then sure enough, here were stacks and stacks and stacks of material. As we went to visit there, I would leave my summer reading at home and instead just kind of dip my hands into those trunks and start reading. And eventually the family donated a large portion of her papers to the Schlesinger Library. But he was still alive, her son, and he did not want to donate her personal papers. You know,
sure.
So that's what I've been working with pretty much on a full-time basis since in the last 10 years. That's what I've been organizing.
Now, did the collection include early drafts of the sex side of life and things like that?
Yes, it does. It does. And her drawings and even the plates that were used in the first printing of the sex side of life. It's really an astounding collection because it's not only Mary Ware's life, but it also goes back. It includes her parents' letters that were written back in the 1840s and their love letters. So part of the joy in really uncovering Mary's story has been to go back, to take that step back in time to see the world that she was born into and who these people were and the incredible influence that they had on her life as a child, growing up with these two feminists, this MIT chemist in the 1880s. So anyway, that's been a real treat.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. And then presumably also to be able to tell her further descendants about how important she is will also be a treat. I mean, I'm amazed at how many people have very prominent ancestors and don't really know it or don't really know how deep their importance goes.
Yeah. Well, it's also been fun, too, because this house is just, I swear sometimes I think that she's hanging around and she's shoving letters at me from time to time. I know I've gone through certain trunks before. And then suddenly last summer I was there and I thought, I can't quite remember what's in here. And I opened up the trunk and it was like, oh, no, it was good news, bad news, because the whole thing was filled with more of her papers. So, it's the house that keeps on giving.
Well, that's good. And thank goodness she saved it because, another thing is people don't do that as often as they should.
No, people don't. And especially, with everything being digital today, too, people don't. Mm-hmm. They don't save letters. They don't write letters.
No.
And these letters and these journals are just such an interesting period in history. It just shed so much light on what was happening on the day-to-day activities, how someone lived their life in that era.
Right. Well, her papers, as you say, are at the Schlesinger Library at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, and you can get, and we put links on the blog post for this episode on there because you can look at a number of the materials in the collection that the family donated are scanned and are digitized. Right. Most of them are printed pamphlets and things like that. But it's a fascinating way to look at one of the many people involved in one of these extremely important issues. So it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show and enlightening us about this very, very important person.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoy your podcast and I enjoy talking about Mary Ware Dennett. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, well, it's been great. And we'll say to the Buzzkillers out there that we will talk to all of you next week.